The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Well, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. So, science and skepticism have been making a lot of headlines lately. The moon bombing, the H1N1 vaccine, Ardipithecus. There's a lot going on, and people are paying attention. But that's not always the case. And even when it is it the kind of attention we want? So today, we'll be talking about getting noticed. We're pleased to have two guests with us, Greg Layden, biological anthropologist and blogger, and Omar Mualim, rapper and journalist. But first, we have our regularly scheduled installment of Speaking Up. Hello, Raven Hanna, founder of Made with Molecules. Are you there?
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. We've been trying to get you on for a while. So tell us a bit about Made with Molecules.
Well, Made with Molecules, I started about 4 years ago. I started making jewelry that in the shape of molecules. And this is sort of based on my deep love of molecules from back when I was a biochemist.
And you received your degree in biochemistry from Yale, did you not?
Yes, I did. And actually in molecular biophysics and biochemistry.
Well, tell us how you went from that to making jewelry.
Yeah, it's a strange path. I loved graduate school, and then I went to do a postdoc. And I found that my interest in science was sort of waning as I had to get more and more and more specific. I'm kind of more of a generalist. And I realized that reading about different kinds of science, like string theory and other stuff, sort of rekindled my love of science. And so I decided that I wasn't suited for a research career. And I was really interested in communicating scientific concepts, especially to people who don't really think that science is interesting. I kind of loved the challenge of making science seem relevant and interesting and cool to people. So I decided to pursue a career in science communication and wanted to do it through visual means because there's a lot of great stuff already out there for people who know that they like science. There's great books and wonderful Nova episodes. But I really wanted to get out a type of person that doesn't know to pick up that stuff. And so I thought a great way to do that would be through art. But I didn't quite know how to become a science communicator through art. So I got training in science writing and at the same time made myself a serotonin necklace, was wearing it around, and people kept telling me that they liked it. I had the experience of people asking me in a mall about it. So I got to give science lessons in a mall. And I thought, this is science communication. This is exactly what I'm striving to do. So that's when I started selling molecule jewelry and didn't really expect it to be my main source of income. But within a year and a half, it turned out to be.
That's amazing. You spoke before the show about a big part of this for you is you feel that symbols are very powerful.
Yeah, I think that humans need symbols in our lives, just as sort of, I would say, almost a reminder of deep concepts and meanings to us, and as a sort of a shorthand. And for me personally, and I think for a lot of other people, the classic symbols in our society aren't meaningful anymore. And I'm thinking of people who wear around a cross on their neck or Star of David or something like that, something that has a spiritual meaning to them.
Right.
And none of that really appealed to me, but molecules did. And so the serotonin to me is a symbol of happiness and it's a symbol that emotions are all generated by chemicals in my brain, which actually really helps me to remember. And it seems that from the feedback I've gotten that a lot of other people appreciate my jewelry, the jewelry I make as personal symbols for themselves.
So is that one of the things that decide what molecules you choose to turn into jewelry, the symbolic value?
Yes, definitely. I want to make molecules that people have some sort of connection with, that they'll want to wear a lot and say something about themselves as a person as well. These pieces really do attract attention, and they're great conversation starters. So wearing something that starts a conversation about something you care about is definitely important. I started with the neurotransmitters like serotonin, dopamine, acetylcholine, things that make mood and emotion. And then I continued on and made caffeine because it was much requested, and other food molecules that people love. So some of the symbols I think are really deep, and some of them are, you know, a little bit more fun, but I think they're all symbolic to people.
You consider yourself more of a science communicator than an artist.
Yes.
So, and you do a couple of different science communication projects, actually, in addition to doing science writing and to doing Made with Molecules.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about the one that I find most fascinating is the Science Tarot?
Yeah. So this is a project we've been working on for about 5 years, and I'm so excited about it. It will be ready at the first part of 2010. And what we did was we took the traditional meanings of each tarot card and express them using a scientific concept. For example, there's a card called the Lovers, which is about finding a balance between being an individual and being in a relationship. And for that, we chose to depict it as a binary star system, because if the stars get out of balance, if they're too close, they'll spiral into each other. If they're too far away, then the relationship doesn't hold. So we were just trying to take this tool that has had meaning to humans for a long time and express it in concepts that, you know, people like me, a science nerd, might enjoy. We think that this is going to be a great science communication tool to get science concepts out to an audience that may not necessarily come across them.
And so where can people find you and your work?
My website is madewithmolecules.com, and the Science Tarot website is sciencetarot.com. And if you sign up on the mailing list there, we will tell you when we have decks.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Raven, for being here today.
Thank you so much. It was so fun.
I hope I can talk you into doing a full episode on microbiology someday.
I would love to. Absolutely.
Wonderful. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, @skepticalradio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And we're going to be talking today about how the skeptical community gets the word out. So here in the studio with me is Omar Mualim. Omar is an award-winning journalist who is currently associate editor of Avenue Magazine here in Edmonton. And he also raps as DJ AOK, or Assault of Knowledge.
No DJ. No DJ?
No DJ. Is that passé?
So,
okay, we're gonna talk about the intricacies of rap at some other point.
I'm more MCAOK.
MCAOK. Yeah. See, this is all about. Yeah. This is not semantics, though. This is a big issue.
No, this is rap semantics. This is musical semantics.
We're going to do a whole show on this one day. So thanks for being here, Omar.
Thank you.
And Greg Layden, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Lovely. Thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
Greg is a Harvard-educated biological anthropologist from Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's the author of the descriptively titled Greg Layden's blog, subtitled Science as Culture, Culture as Science. So welcome both of you to Skeptically Speaking.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start off with what people think of skeptics. Sort of what's the image that comes into your mind when someone says that word, Omar?
When you say skeptic, and this is just because I'm more aware that there is a global skeptical community, I think of Tam. I think, forgive me, I do think a little bit nerdy. I think of blogs and YouTube, and I think of conferences. When I think of skeptical people, of course, I just think of the guy who, in an office conversation about astrology, speaks up and says, well, here's why these generalizations don't fit.
Craig, what about you?
Well, I do think of the concept of a conflict between people who have different ideas of what being a skeptic is. Because I hear the word in regards to 911 denialists or Holocaust denialists, that sort of thing. The word skeptic is used very widely. And I think that I agree with what Omar said. And that's what I think skeptics really are. And that's how we should really be using the word. I also think about because I'm more involved in the atheist community and have been for longer than the skeptics community, I think of atheists automatically, and that may not be accurate.
It's often not accurate at all. A lot of 9/11 truthers would identify themselves as atheists and would also probably call themselves skeptics as well. But by failing to look at the factual information behind the 9/11 incident and using that toward their claims, they're being askeptical.
And that's what's interesting here, because what we're talking about is perception. And skepticism is supposed to be about fact and evidence. But evidence is unfortunately not enough to change people's minds sometimes, especially when we're talking about deeply held beliefs.
I think a lot of people just put skepticism and cynicism together, and that is a perception of skeptics, mm-hmm. is cynical people.
Well, and that's some of that is presentation, which is exactly what we're talking about. So let's start with some specific examples of presentation. Greg, do you want to talk a bit about ARDI?
Sure. Just to give some background, ARDI is it stands for the genus species Ardipithecus, which is an early hominid, 4.5 million years old or so from Northeast Africa. It was discovered decades ago, but only recently a bunch of articles came out all at once describing all kinds of things about its physical appearance and its behavior and so on. And when it came out with a fair amount of publicity with the papers. There wasn't much advanced publicity, but there was a fair amount of publicity when the papers came out. And compared to a couple months ago when Ida, the fossil monkey, was announced, in which the species name, the press releases, the full-size book, the motion picture starring Alistair Cook, the press releases and the scientific papers all came out at the same exact moment. Ardipithecus was a mild, relatively controlled, not terribly obnoxious example of an important scientific find. But had Ida not occurred recently, I think Ardipithecus would be seen as a bit of a splash. And I think the big issue there is, in human evolution studies, when these new finds come out, we're always asked about the questions of missing link or if a particular fossil is an ancestor of humans or not. And people, there's famous fights about people saying my fossil is a human ancestor, your fossil is not, and vice versa. One great example of one of those fights was played out, and if you could ever see the tape of this, it was played out, it was the Merv Griffin Show. Richard Leakey and Donald Johanson fighting on the Merv Griffin Show with charts and tables and casts over which of their hominids was the actual human ancestor. And there's a little bit of that in the Ardipithecus release.
Right. But this is not new, Ardi.
No.
This does nothing to change our views on human evolution at all.
If you weren't paying attention and didn't know a lot about human evolution or weren't following it and studying it, this sounds like it has some new stuff. The idea that Ardipithecus walked differently than modern humans, which it does, was stated in the very first article that was written about it. The details of that are what's come out. I guess the thing is, this is an important set of papers because of the rich details they give and the data they provide, but the basic facts aren't different because of this recent set of publications from what we were thinking 15 years ago.
Okay, so, because that's interesting, because that wasn't exactly how it was presented. In fact, National Geographic, when I looked, 2 weeks ago, I guess it was now, it said, oldest human skeleton found disproves missing link. And the first thing, you know, that I thought is, oh crap, how did they get it wrong this time?
Well, what they're saying there is the so-called missing link is the ancestor of modern humans and chimpanzees. Mm-hmm. That's what they're referring to specifically as the missing link. And it is missing. Missing link is a term that a lot of modern skeptics claim should never be used because it's a meaningless term. It's not. It actually does mean something. Humans and chimpanzees are pretty different. And knowing the evolutionary sequence of events that leads to those differences is an important evolutionary question. And the missing pieces in those puzzles are missing links, in a sense. Most things that are called missing links are not links.
Right.
And they're often not missing. The human-chimp missing link really is missing. We don't really have any fossils of that period. And Ardipithecus is close, maybe. It gives us a good idea of what this common ancestor may have looked like. And it looks exactly like we expected, as far as I thought. So it wasn't. It doesn't disprove anything, as far as I know. I mean, it's cool. It's really important, but it
definitely. Now we could do a whole show on media's obligation to the public, but this one is about how skeptics present themselves. So part of that is about how scientists present their studies. So do you think scientists were at fault in either of these situations?
I think that in the case of Ida, what was wrong there was a very large scale press push that about a really important fossil find, in which the details of the fossil find that are needed by other scientists to evaluate the legitimacy of the claims were not available.
Right.
Even to this day, they're not available yet. The paper that came out is not thorough enough for everyone to evaluate the claims that were made. And that's the fault of the scientists. Otherwise, it's a great find, and I don't know if I'm against or for. I mean, scientists often don't understand communication to media, and I'm not sure that coming out with a popular book and an Alistair Cook movie the same day that you announce your fossil is a bad idea. I mean, it might be a good idea. It's what you say when you do it that's important. And so maybe this is a new phenomenon that will adjust and it will come out and work better. With Ardipithecus, I don't know, I guess I just feel that it was not that badly done. It's not the worst example that I've seen.
Right.
Of egregious pandering to public purient interests. And in fact, what was said in the press releases was more or less what the papers say. I read a lot of press releases and compare them to a lot of, as part of the blogging for peer-reviewed research project and so on, I read a lot of press releases in the original papers, and there are times when there is absolutely no connection whatsoever.
Right.
And that often happens when an important find has been printed, published, regarding the molecular inner workings of cells, and then this is connected to the idea that we've moved closer to curing cancer. And there's nothing about cancer in the article. It isn't mentioned.
Right.
And everything we learn about cells is going to help us cure cancer in some way, eventually. So it's a trivial connection, and it's you know, you can often read science where you can't explain all the science to the public in a normal way. It cannot all be explained without specialized knowledge. And so we know, especially when you can't do that, you just make stuff up and put it in the press release.
Right. Well, without actually, you know, maliciously trying to change the intent of a study, we definitely can make the message clearer, right? Scientists and skeptics don't have to run around afterwards saying that's not what we meant.
I am in a complete agreement, and I'm one of the only scientists you'll ever hear say this. I am in complete agreement with Randy Olson and what he says in his book that just came out, which is titled "Don't Be Such a Scientist," in which he says number one rule. In talking to the public about science, number one rule that should never be broken is never make stuff up. Okay, always tell it like it is, the truth that you know what you know about. Okay, and then beyond that, it's a lot of talk about how scientists are pretty bad at understanding how the public needs to understand things. And what I find interesting is all of the personal conversations I've had with other scientists about that book, and some of the reviews have come out, all say Randy Olson is doing it wrong and ruining it for everybody because he's telling scientists to make stuff up.
Well, let's ask a journalist. We happen to have one here. Omar, how can scientists help you? how can they make the message clearer?
You know, I don't know how scientists can make things clear. I mean, I can tell you that we don't get a lot of press releases from studies from scientists, and I feel, I mean, and I could only speak for the magazine I work for and the other publications I've worked for. I felt like there was a disconnect between scientific understanding and the public, and I feel like journalism is that, it's the mediator, it's the hub there, it is what can take hard to understand, hard crunched information to layman's terms, or not even layman's terms, but just a well-read and well-written article about something that is astounding, something like nanotechnology, which is very hard to conceive. I do think that journalists hesitate to reach out to scientists a lot when they're doing articles. If they reach out to scientists, it's a social scientist usually.
Is that because they're afraid that they won't understand what the scientists are saying?
And yeah, rightfully. I mean, I've had that experience fact-checking or interviewing scientists, and one, being slightly annoyed by the fastidiousness of scientists when fact-checking, and two, just completely not understanding it, and in an attempt to sort of put it in layman's terms or create a more common or understandable analogy, getting some resistance because it's not completely true or it's not what they do, trying to project from there, there's definitely some resistance.
Well, one of the things that people say is an answer, a potential answer to this is blogs and having scientists just, you know, create their own communication. Greg, what do you think? You are a science blogger. Do you think that's actually the direction we need to go?
Before I answer that question, I'd like to add something in between here as a segue a little bit, because as Omar was talking, I remembered an incident that occurred that I'm going to offend some people here, but I think it's worth saying, and I won't use any real names, but I was asked to go to a famous museum about a year ago and stand around with five or six other scientists and look at the exhibit that they were putting up prior to its, you know, a week before it was going up, and they had all the text in draft form to make comments about the text and make comments about the objects being displayed and so on. And some of the people there knew a lot about the museum and what was in the museum. And I found it very interesting that there were five or six academics, and it was a different environment to be in. And everybody seemed to be most interested in making sure that everyone else knew that they knew interesting esoteric facts that would never, ever get on this exhibit. I mean, this thing's about, you know, if you put this particular species up in this picture, somebody might come along and realize that the sample you have in the case is actually a subspecies that's a different one from the other side of Australia. You know, and we're talking about a sponge or something. You know, and then, of course, they would all say, well, but it doesn't matter for the exhibit, okay?
That's interesting.
I got to say, journalists are very often very guilty of just taking the most interesting but also sometimes the most unimportant information from scientific studies, from scientists, when doing a story that involves science, and just using that because it's interesting, because they can use it in their lead.
Well, yeah, and I think that the experience I had resonates with what you're saying, in the sense that if you're trying to get the basic story from the scientists, you know, the exhibit designer was an experienced person who's done a lot of exhibits with a lot of scientists, and he was very patient, and he was expecting what he got. And it was useful. A lot of errors were corrected, and useful stuff happened. But most, and I remember it especially because I only had a half an hour. I had to go, and I remember thinking, "Stop talking about the esoteric crap, you know,
right?
And answer the question: is this label, you know, erroneous or not?" And I think that a lot of science conversation among scientists is justifiably like that. That's how we talk, because, you know, there's a great deal of skepticism within science, and it's an operative, functional part of the fabric of doing science is not – someone tells you something and you just – the first thing you do is you don't believe them. That's what you do first. And then you talk to them like you don't believe them. And when that spills out into talking to the public, that's not how people talk. And I'm not saying we should make stuff up or expound beliefs, but you have to recognize the fact that people do – communicate in their day-to-day lives a certain way, and you can't just show up with a whole different way of communication and expect people to relate to that unless you're talking to science geeks.
Well,
and that works. You know, we can talk to science geeks like we talk to each other, and science geeks love that, but there's not that many science geeks.
Well, then what's the deal with blogs? Are blogs in a more common language? Does it allow scientists to speak in layman's terms, or is it just more jargon-filled?
I think it depends on the blog.
Exactly. It depends a lot on the blog. I mean, I think that I don't believe that there's an entity called blogging. I think that blogging is a medium. It's like driving, and you could be a driver of a school bus or a driver of your own personal car or a driver of a train, and they're all different. You know, driving is not the thing that you are. It's the thing you're doing, and blogging is not the thing that you are for most people. It's the thing that you do as something else, and you see the full range of people communicating in different styles in blogs. However, blogs do something that's special that other forms of communication don't do, and that is if you have a blog in which you allow comments and you don't restrict them too much, you let your commenters kind of go wild sometimes and not throw anyone off that disagrees with you immediately, and you get a community commenting on your site, that actually allows for some communication that otherwise wouldn't happen. And I think that that can be useful. Although commenter communities also form around specific blogs. I've had the experience numerous times of reading a blog I hadn't read before, making a comment, and then having all the commenters yell at me because I had made my first comment.
Right.
And it's sometimes those are political blogs, but sometimes they're science blogs, and it's like, oh, excuse me, but I opened my mouth. Sorry, I'll go away now. And it's not very welcoming. So, but commenting at least allows a person to be held a little bit accountable for how they said something and what they said, and they have to re-explain things and readjust.
Now, audience, if you want to comment or open your mouth or some such, please do call 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio.
I got a question for Greg. Do agree with you that that blogs are great for generating a dialogue and also for mobilizing a community, but do you think that it does much to bring people into that community?
No, I actually think they're pretty... So far, I think blogs have been really bad at that. I mean, I'll tell you that I currently have two kinds of friends. I could categorize all my friends into two categories. It would work. Friends that don't read my blog and friends that do read my blog. And the ones that don't read my blog are the friends that I had before I started blogging. And the friends that do read my blog are people that are friends because they read my blog. That's how I met them. And the only exception is my wife, who tends to read my blog, and otherwise wouldn't have read blogs. And that's it. So I have close friends that in the past have literally, like, you know, laid down on mud for me, saved my life, that kind of stuff, and they won't read my blog because they just don't read blogs. And I don't think blogs are magnets. I think they're serving pre-existing communities in new ways that are useful and important, but they're not expansive and expanding the word about much of anything.
Right. Well, then, since that doesn't work, let's talk about some less academic ways of getting noticed. Now, there were some paintings displayed in Washington, D.C. as part of the recent Blasphemy Day event. And one was entitled, Jesus Does His Nails. And I'll just give you some background on that. For anybody that doesn't know about this, that's listening, according to blasphemyday.com, it's held on the last day in September, and it's the anniversary of the original publication of the Danish cartoons in 2005 that depicted the prophet Muhammad's face. And any visual depiction of Muhammad is considered a grave offense under Islamic law. And the publication of the cartoons led to massive riots, attacks on foreign embassies, and death. So the point of Blasphemy Day is to open up all religious beliefs to the same level of free inquiry, discussion, and criticism. And so this is part of it, this painting. The painting was of a picture of Jesus using nail polish to paint the nails in his hands.
Did we ever find out where that painting was?
It was in a private showing. Not a private showing per se, but it wasn't in a public place.
Right. And see, I think this is what makes Blasphemy Day a good idea, as opposed to a bad idea, which is going out into the streets and just blaspheming in people's faces or holding up signs and taking up posters. I like the idea of sort of a global festival and little venues or little pockets on people's websites and in on stages and in galleries that at the same time invite people to challenge the sacredness of religion. What I don't like is evangelizing that, and that's what I hope isn't done with Blasphemy Day, and I that's what I hope Blasphemy Day doesn't become.
Well, and that's really what I want to talk about. Now, there is some overlap between the skeptical community and the atheist community, and the atheist community is a well-established community, and so we can learn a lot of lessons from them. But does this kind of in-your-face action ever work? Now, not particularly this one, but if that image was in a public place, would you have a different perspective? Is that a good recruiting technique, is I guess what I want to know.
It's a good offending technique.
Right. But that would be different.
I don't think it's going to take someone from the edge of like, oh, maybe there's, you know, maybe Christ is my Lord, maybe Christ is not. I see that. And then, oh, he's not. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it will enrage one side and it will empower the other side. If you want to completely isolate that middle and the right side over it, then that's what I think it would do.
What do you think, Greg?
Well, I am a hypocrite, and I have completely situational ethics in regards to most of these things. So I think I kind of represent, you know, the way people usually are, in a sense that people are very complex. You know, if I personally don't find something offensive, I have a hard time noticing that it's offensive and thinking that it's offensive. And I very much support and am often part of the kind of harder left atheist action that people like P.C. Myers do. Mm-hmm. I like that stuff, and Rebecca Watson, and you know, I think she did the first blasphemy video. At the same time, I understand what you're saying. I agree that you are going to be messing with the middle here, but if you don't have yourself positioned, at least some of your allies positioned far to one extreme, then the middle is going to be moving away from you at the same time. To me, I think, you know, I have in my mind the blasphemy video that I want to see made, which is a bit more than just someone saying blasphemous things, which are, you know, whatever, usually not clever or funny,
right,
although they can be. And that is, you know, imagine a scenario in which you have a room full of people at an event like Thanksgiving, and this is an American holiday, or Easter, or any kind of a family event where lots of people are together, and someone gets everyone's attention and thanks them all for arriving at the event and for being there. And then some person, maybe grandma or grandpa or someone, you know, dinner's coming up, so they say, well, let's say grace now. And they start to pray, and everyone's head bows down, except for one person's head, who stands there not participating in this moment. And the patriarch of the family who has asked this elder to pray spies the individual whose head is not bowed down and gives them a really, really dirty look, because the fact that their head is not bowed is a kind of blasphemy to them. And to make the point that that's actually what it's like to be an atheist in a community in which everyone else is not an atheist, like where I live in the Upper Midwest. I used to live in Boston, and it's really different there. Here in Minneapolis, this situation I just described happens to me 3 or 4 times a year, and it happens to a lot of atheists. And it's, well, you don't get the glaring look because people around here aren't nice, but you still know that you're not, you know,
right,
not like the others. And to me, that's a more meaningful blasphemy, and that's a more meaningful statement to make that actually is more of an indictment. I mean, screaming about the Bible is fine, but complaining that grandma is being a jerk because she's praying for you is different. People,
right,
don't want to hear that, and that's a much more powerful statement, and it's a much more relevant and true statement, I think.
So do you think that the kind of, you know, the shock and awe, the in-your-face kind of things, do you think they're actually detrimental?
I think they can be detrimental, but I think they can also be, but so can not doing things. Let me just very quickly, you know, mention, I think the best example of this that's happened recently is a famous, besides the Blasphemy Day, is a famous, you know, frack and cracker incident with P.C. Myers, where to make it really quick, there was a student in Florida who got in big trouble and got thrown out of school and stuff because he attempted to abscond with a Holy Eucharist from a Catholic ceremony. P.C. blogged about this and was attacked by the Catholic League. So what P.C. did was to eventually create an act of blasphemy systematically, in which he got a Eucharist and he got a rusty nail and he pierced the Eucharist with a nail. He put the nail in a garbage can with crumpled up pieces of the Bible, crumpled up pages from the Quran, and crumpled up pages from Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion, some coffee grounds, and banana peels. Now, what people didn't notice at the time, as an aside, is if you look closely at the banana peels, you can see the image of Jesus Christ in little black spots. But aside, putting that aside,
that was atrocious.
This is an event of blasphemy, and he published this on his blog. He put this photograph of this with an essay that, if you read it by itself, it's one of the most moving essays I have read on a blog, in which he describes, and it's incredibly powerful and important, and the Catholic League didn't say anything about it because they were just, it killed them. It was the end of the argument, in which P.C. pointed out that the same document from the Vatican that made the Eucharist, instead of just a piece of bread, that made it holy, that made it the body of Christ from now on, also specified that from now on, the Jews living in Europe would be wearing a star to signify that they are Jews. Same document. So the same document that leads to Webster Cook being thrown out of the student council and the college because he tried to Steele Eucharist is the same document that ultimately led to the Holocaust. So now, are we really talking about somebody being too far on the left or too radical in their atheism compared to the Holocaust, or compared to all the bad stuff religion can do, or compared to a rational argument about whether or not people in America or Canada or any other free country should be thrown out of school because they disrespected a religious ceremony?
Now, we have an email.
Yes, this email is from Daniel Luxton. He says, in my opinion, Randy Olson nails it a lot of the time. The central question of A Flock of Dodos, who would you matta have a beer with, is his exact words, seems like a powerful science communication insight. After all, communication is only achieved when someone listens, and why would anyone listen if we aren't likable? So if Olson is saying something important, why does he take so much heat?
Well, I think Randy takes a lot of heat because from scientists, because he explicitly says that most scientists do not understand how to communicate with the public. And almost all scientists that I know are very smart people who have been stroked for their knowledge their entire lives, and they don't really think that there's not much that they don't understand or can't understand. So when they face the issue of communication, they're not skeptical about their own abilities. They just assume that they're good at it, and they don't listen to outside advice about these things. And this will get a lot of people mad at me for saying that, but it's just true. Most scientists have egos that are like granite, and they can't be told that they're wrong about much. And Randy has told them that, and he's right, and so they get really mad at him.
So again, callers, if you'd like to get involved, the number is 780-492-2577, extension 1, or live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or tweet us at Skeptical Radio.
Can I add something about whether radical atheism works or not? I don't know what the numbers are in America. In Canada, the number of people who identify themselves as agnostic and atheist is on the rise dramatically. I believe it's gone something from 7% to 14% in a matter of about 20 years or so. Now, I don't know for sure, don't have it in front of me, but it has basically doubled in a short period of time. And this is without a very loud, squeaky movement. This is with people who I think actually a large part of it might be people who see radical Christians, radical Muslims, just radical fundamental religious people, and actually pushing themselves away from that and coming closer to the middle or closer to the agnostic atheist side. And so I think that it's possible that being meek, understanding, intelligent, picking your battles might actually be working. I mean, it might take, maybe it's not, maybe we need to be more radical and we'll get that, you know, we'll take that 14% to 28% in Canada in a matter of 5 years. But something is working, if at least at a nice pace, I think.
So how does that work with skepticism, though? How do we be, how can we be meek and polite and such about science?
Well, I got to say, at the same time, I mean, religion and skepticism are different things. I mean, this comes back to people who are atheists but don't really practice skepticism. So can it really be treated equally? Religion is such a hot topic. It's a very touchy topic. I don't think people are going to be up in arms if you laugh at them for believing in ghosts or make fun of them because they have their astrology sign tattooed on their lower back.
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. If you have if P.Z. Myers was here, he would say, or Richard Dawkins, and I would agree with them, that religion has a special place in society. And when someone is completely wrong because when someone is spouting astrology or numerology or is looking for ghosts or whatever, that's not as protected. Mm-hmm. You can tell those people that they're crazy a little bit more easily. It's more it's perfectly reasonable for the editor of a newspaper, the publisher, the main publisher of a newspaper, to come out and say, we don't believe in our astrologists, although we print it for entertainment value.
Right.
But not to come out and say, we don't believe in our religion commenter, we just print it for entertainment value. There's a difference. You can't diss religion at all in our society, in Canada or the U.S. And by the way, the numbers of increasing number of agnosticism and atheism are similar in the U.S. You can't diss those religion in North America in the public forum, in newspapers, on radio and on TV, the same way you can diss astrology. And yet they're both made up stuff. And I agree. I mean, I have to say that, you know, I hope no one is listening here because I'm revealing a secret here. But, you know, I do sort of radical atheism on one side, but I'm also a member of the Minnesota Atheists. The Minnesota Atheists, and I work with them on things. And the Minnesota Atheists are the nice atheists. This is what you're saying, you know, Omar. It's the middle ground. It's inviting people into the conversation. It's always being nice. The Minnesota Atheists have a stretch of highway. In the U.S., we have a thing where you adopt a highway and you go out and, like, pick the litter up every year.
That's
you
wonderful.
Know, we've adopted a highway. We do public service. We march with various liberal causes just as, you know, we go along. And we have a radio show. And in the radio show, you know, I've been a host on it and I've been a guest on it. And we have a rule that they had to tell me because, you know, I'm the atheist blogger. They said, just make sure you don't do any of that PZ Myers stuff while you're hosting here. Because that's how we do it. And it's actually how you should do it. We need to have, I personally think, the full range of the spectrum of activism. We need all of it. And we need to internally work together. And I have sat down and had a meal and coffee or conversations with Jeannie Scott of the National Center for Science Education, who is the centrist, mainstream, anti-creationism person, and PZ Myers, and me, and a few other people at the same time. And the issue of how to approach these things has never been raised.
Interesting.
We just don't talk about it. We just do our thing. Mm. We respect each other, and we don't particularly strategize much either. We just sort of all know what we're doing.
Okay, well, let's just talk about credibility for a second there. Now, I understand the concept of, you know, getting the message out, and some of this is about building your base and such. But Omar, as mm-hmm. again, as a journalist, is there a different – would you take people differently if they did some kind of loud, bombastic, attention-grabbing campaign versus the kind of people, maybe like the Australian skeptics, who it's very nose to the grindstone, hard work, get the information out, produce materials. Do you treat them differently?
Oh, certainly. It's annoying. It's annoying to have people constantly calling you or, you know, sending you press releases with, this has to stop now. I think of, I mean, one example of this, and this is actually an askeptical example of this, is how the 9/11 truthers have done a horrible job about getting into mainstream media. And, I mean, part of it is because, you know, 9/11 is sort of a sacred day in America, but I think a large part of it is because of how on fire they are when you talk to them. You can't have a civil conversation with them, and nobody really wants to bring them on their radio show or TV show to discuss it because it's not civil. And then you look at the places where they have had success, and that is largely in the Middle East. And putting that in context, if you watch, as I've watched my whole life, a lot of Arab news, it's the show thrives off angry and just completely uncivil discussions and screaming and yelling and a host who starts yelling at both people. I don't think that in our journalism, in our culture's journalism at least, the greasy wheel always gets... Wait. Greasy wheel always gets the oil?
No.
Squeaky wheel always gets the grease. Yeah. Yes, that's the one.
So I think we have a lot more to talk about, and we're going to get to that right after the break.
Next time on Skeptically Speaking, we'll be talking with Keith Skaun about digital footprints, how computers can track behavior and find out all your dirty little secrets. What are the limits on what your company is allowed to find out about you, and how are they doing it? Who's really making the decisions in your organization? How do we figure out, after the fact, whether, yeah, go do that means, yes, go grab me some lunch, or, yes, perpetuate that multi-million-dollar fraud scheme? How much privacy is it reasonable to give up for how much security? Join us on the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Again, I'm still in the studio with Omar Mualim of Avenue Magazine and a skeptical MC.
I'm a rapper who I rap skeptically. How about that?
How about that?
Yeah, okay. No, the MC you got fine. I'm a rapper who, yes, I rap skeptically. I don't want to pigeonhole myself as a man who only raps about science, or a man who only raps about creationism,
right.
Or
and that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about in this section. And we're also here with Greg Layden of Greg Layden's blog, and who is on the side a biological anthropologist. And if you want to join in the conversation, do call in to 780-492-2577, extension 1, email live at skepticallyspeaking.com, or email, or tweet, Skeptical Radio. There's so many ways to get a hold of us. So I guess one of the things that I want to talk about now is about the arts. It doesn't just have to be academic. It doesn't have to be controversial public events. We don't necessarily need that to make headlines. It could be quite pleasant, even. Mm-hmm. And you and I were actually speaking about this, Omar, before, about, you know, nobody walks around quoting Michael Shermer, or at least very few people.
Right.
On the other hand, I walk around humming I Love the Whole World from the Discovery Channel ad all the time. So why... You know, that's very accessible. It's very catchy. Do those kind of things have more of a chance of breaking through?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's one area of fault with blogs, is that although they are incredibly accessible, it is it's sort of like having an open door to a bathroom in a restaurant, but not having any signs to show people how to get there. I mean, I think about how I got into skepticism. It was through Penn and Teller's show... Bolshevik.
Thank you. That was for our Americans. Yes. We're allowed to swear in Canada.
very mainstream show on Showtime. And, you know, it was through them that I learned about Michael Shermer, then learned about Skeptic Magazine, then I learned about Skeptic's Guide Through Universe, James Randi, and then the rest of it, and then here I am now. And I wouldn't have gotten there if it wasn't for this very mainstream show called Bolshevik. I'd like to see more skepticism in mainstream TV and music, and it doesn't have to. In fact, it shouldn't flag itself as, you know, skeptical programming coming up. It should just be, you know, if a favorite rap group of mine, Dead Prez, these are two black guys from a very poor place in New York, and when they talk about misery and devastation, they talk about it through the eyes of people who believe there can't be a God because of what they've seen. This is skeptical, but it's not skeptical rap. It's two rappers rapping skeptically.
Right. And it's critical analysis.
And it's critical analysis. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to tell them too much because they've also said some pretty ignorant things as well, namely, you know, white people creating AIDS, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But that's another thing. I mean, I think that's another example of how religion and skepticism are so often separated by people. I think about fiction, very underrepresented in fiction, skepticism. I watched that movie Year One with Jack Black and Michael Cera. Very funny. And what I loved about the first 89 minutes of that movie is every religious occurrence in this movie is explained by coincidence, by reason, by, oh, it's just that guy over there. And then at 90 minutes, the movie decides it's going to perform a miracle. And that kind of upset me. But the first 89 minutes, excellent, great, and funny. And South Park does these great episodes about celebrity ghosts and the ghost hunters and how, you know, they're huge douchebags. And they did a 9/11 Truthers one, which was extra hilarious. Scientology, I mean, they handle these things. It seems that we, or at least the entertainers, when they do handle a topic of skepticism, it's usually directed toward an adult group, I've noticed. In the 70s, kids used to have Scooby-Doo and Nancy Drew and Encyclopedia Brown and the Hardy Boys to get their critical analysis from, or their critical thinking skills from. My generation, at least, we grew up on Goosebumps, which, I mean, you know, if it were the Hardy Boys, the evil lawn gnomes were explained by some sort of, you know, puppetry. But my generation, when we heard about evil lawn gnomes, they were actually evil lawn gnomes. And
we actually have an email.
This is from Paul Welke. he says, isn't it somewhat intellectually dishonest to refrain from ridiculing the ridiculous? I mean, if people have silly beliefs, isn't it just to attempt to get others to join you in laughing? Also, I commend Greg on participating in his state's Adopt the Highway program, and I'm glad that we've been able to do the same here.
All right.
Yeah, well, I think that that's part of the argument that can be made is that, and I guess I was sort of trying to say this before, we were talking about, you know, we can ridicule the astrologer but not the religion, and that's a hypocritical stance. We have to kind of, even in our skepticism is supposed to be based on irrationality, and there has to be some degree of that. And the degree to which, I guess here's the main point, okay? The degree to which more radical atheism is seen as radical is not defined in many cases by the atheism itself or the skepticism itself. It's defined by the other side of the equation, okay? If a religion says, we think there is a spiritual nature to the universe, but we're not sure, and someone skeptically says, I don't think so, you know, whatever. If a religion says, we have a person that 2,000 years ago died for your sins, and if you don't go along with that, then you're going to go to hell, and the response to that is going to be a bit more extreme. And it's not more extreme because the responders are more extreme. It's more extreme because the initial statement is very extreme, and because it includes all kinds of things in the package, like as a child growing up, if you misbehave in context of this belief system, then you will suffer eternal damnation, which is what Christians tell their children. And the reaction to that might be more extreme than just thinking, oh, there's a spiritual aspect of the universe, but we're not sure what it is. Okay, so radicalness is often defined by what it's reacting to, not entirely, you know, internally.
But Omar, you're saying it doesn't necessarily need to be radical. Maybe it could just be, you know, a really good music or a really good book with skeptical aspects.
Absolutely. I do think it is. Now, I do think you have every right to react to such extreme, any views that offend you, and that, with the example of eternal damnation, threaten you with the same kind of extremism. And I think you have every right to get in people's face about that. I'm completely opposed to getting people's being the initiator. With putting it in your, as an artist, and putting it in your art, that is, I think, a fair way to initiate a discussion.
So would you encourage other people like you to maybe not, you know, someone like George Harab, he definitely is well known for his skepticism, mm-hmm. And he makes great music. But someone like you, you rap. Mm-hmm. And you have some skeptical songs.
Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, I want to do a song about losing my, I want to do a song about intelligent design. That I thought was interesting, regardless of, you know, trying to fit it into this skeptical niche at all. And I wanted to make a song that anatomizes intelligent design for what it is. And, you know, I wasn't going out to try to target this skeptical niche of people or demographic of people. I was just trying to make a song with skepticism. And if it inspires one of the listeners, if that song of the 12 that are on my album should get the person to investigate their religious beliefs a little bit more or investigate evolution a little bit more, then mission accomplished, I think.
Well, Why don't you inspire us?
Let's hear it.
is this where I rap?
This is where you rap.
This is a very new song. In fact, for anyone on watching the simulcast of this, I'm rapping off my phone because I just wrote this not too long ago.
There is so much nerd in this room.
Isn't it true? And it's a smartphone, of course. It's a song called Still Stupid, tentatively titled. It's a sequel to a song I made about skepticism in politics called Get Stupid. So this is about stupidity in pop culture called Still Stupid. My microphone's still good? Right on. Sylvia Brown predict her own downfall, cause with Montel gone now, who's she gonna call for when her life's took? Cause I knifed that crook, laugh at a ghost, and wrote about it in my next book. Did a press junket, stopped at Larry King's, dressed like an ETC, what Larry thinks, before he starts rambling about what's in the sky, probed his ass with a telescope, he screamed for his life. Next show,
You know I do the big O, tell Winfrey. I brought the best secret with me. Laws of attraction, when it's impacting, fist cracks her skull, the crowd starts clapping. You get a clue, and you get a clue, and you get a clue. It's the absolute truth. There's no such thing as ghosts or leprechauns, and there's no such thing as fairies and no gods. Oprah's the new god, vaccine's the new devil, doubt's the new sin, secret's the new Quran. It's hard to believe we've evolved at all. It's like hard to believe is a calling card. Oprah's the new god, vaccine's the new devil, doubt's the new sin, secret's the new Quran. It's hard to believe we've evolved at all. It's like hard to believe is a calling card. We're friggin' stupid. We're so friggin' stupid. Can we really be that stupid? Uh-huh. Maybe we're that stupid. Uh-huh. Come on, it's 2009. Uh-huh. Are we really that stupid? I guess. But why? Why are we so stupid? Hardwired blind spots got us locked with tired thoughts. It's more than heaven and God. It's fire walking and Eric Von Daniken, the man who mobilizes mannequins and feeds them bestsellers about pre-man civilizations. I'm civil, yes, patient, no. Face to face with wasted ghosts, too drunk to find their way to the afterlife. They crash a night, flash a light. I saw it. It's just a bathrobe dancing in the closet. Check the earth deposit. There's no tools past Homo habilis. Nope. But there's rockets before the manifest. Must be the lunar effect or the lunar homes. I see a face on the moon, it's the lunar homes. It's 2012, I'll tell you what's going down. Impulsive sex and regrets on the 22nd. 9-11 truthers, the 9-11 losers. True, I'd love to think it's an inside job, but my insides tell me that those inside bombs were inside debris from outside salam. Yes, outside, inside, salam. Oprah's the new god, vaccine's the new devil, doubt's the new sin, secret's the new Quran. It's hard to believe we've evolved at all. It's like hard to believe is our calling card. Oprah's the new god, vaccine's the new devil, doubt's the new sin, secret's the new Quran. It's hard to believe we've evolved at all. It's like hard to believe is our calling card.
Hot.
Hot.
That was awesome. Thanks, Omar.
That was radical.
Awesome.
Oh, wow. And that's pretty much our time for the night, guys. Good note to end on. Thanks so much to Omar Mualim and to Greg Layden for being here. And if you want to check out Greg's blog, it's very easy to Google, but to save you time, it's at scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden. And you can find Omar's at assaultofknowledge.wordpress.com. He also, can you actually purchase that album from there?
Yeah, that's, well, no, that's off my new album coming out. But I do have one album called If You Don't Buy the CD, The Terrorists Win, an album you should be very skeptical of. And that is available on iTunes, on Amazon, on my website, on a million different places. Yeah.
Thanks so much to both of you. That was wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And audience, you can visit our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. From there, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, join the Facebook group, or follow us on Twitter. And thanks to the wonders of Ustream, you can also watch us while we're on the air. But that's only for those of you listening live. We are never, ever posting these videos. So click the listen online link on our website, and it automatically takes you there. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
South America does not exist. The moon is painted on the sky. Sometimes fall off, but you never see, and everything you believe is a lie.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. All the hippies are working for the government.